Hi, Allison.
Hi, Max.
Have you got your sticker?
Yes, I have.
Yes.
But all my friends want to be in the Sticker of the Month Club.
Yes.
Just giving them one sticker wasn't enough. They want one to come to them special every month.
Absolutely. So point them towards patreon.com/UrsulaMajor. $5 a podcast gets them part of the Sticker of the Month Club.
Perfect. I'll tell them.
Also, they can go to umpboh.com.
Mm-hmm.
Go to the shop. They're there too.
Beautiful.
Yes.
We're all going to show up wearing our stickers.
At the live episode?
Uh-huh. September 24th. We'll see you there.
Yes, at the Complex on Melrose in Los Angeles.
Perfect.
Yes.
Hello.
Hi, everyone.
Welcome back to
The Bitchery of History.
My name's Allison.
And my name is Max. And this week, I'm going to be talking about Cutaloon.
Get excited.
Yes.
I'm going to be talking about Madame Lou Graham.
Ooh, Madame.
Take it away.
All right. So, Cutaloon is one of the most amazing women. Also, she's done beautifully in Marco Polo on Netflix.
I just started watching that.
So good.
I'm in love with
it. So good. So Cutaloon itself translates to either bright moon or all white. And a little background on the Mongol Empire. At the height of the Mongol Empire, it was the largest contiguous empire in human history.
Whoa.
It stretched from China to Europe and the Middle East. Whew. The empire was started by Genghis Khan, who unified nomadic tribes under a single banner and had a reputation for being a brutal leader. He actually did, though, advance the empire, such as bringing religious tolerance, increased trade, and a meritocracy. He introduced a meritocracy to the system.
Wow.
Cutaloon was Genghis Khan's great-great-granddaughter.
Whoa.
She was born in about 1260. Which is right around the time that the Mongol Empire was starting to decline and fall apart.
Mm-hmm.
The reason being that some of the Khans, like Kaidu, Cutaloon's father, favoring the old ways of riding, shooting, and other trappings of the nomadic lifestyle, while other Khans, like Kublai Khan, Kaidu's uncle, were more focused on politics and governing well. Kublai Khan and Kaidu began warring against each other, which would last for 30 years.
Woof.
By 1280, her father, Kaidu, was the most powerful ruler in Central Asia, reigning from Western Mongolia to Oxus River in Uzbekistan, and from the Central Siberian Plateau to India.
Mm.
She was the only daughter with 14 brothers and the youngest of the family.
Oh, man.
Her father trained her as a Mongolian warrior along with her brothers and relied on her the most for political and military advice.
Yes! Get it, queen!
So her involvement in battle and politics wasn't actually all that uncommon in the Mongol Empire. Like a lot of nomadic groups or tribes, women were given a fair amount of power because it was the best way to divide up labor. It just made sense. While men fought during war campaigns, the women ran the cities. They built public works, they helped manage the largest land empire of all times, and had a seat at the Kuultai, which was the Mongolian Congress. They picked the Khan of Khans. Marco Polo wrote about Cutaloon and described her as a superb warrior, saying, quote, "Sometimes she would quit her father's side and make a dash at the host of the enemy and seize some man thereout as deftly as a hawk pounces on a bird and carry him to her father. And this she did many a time."
Beautiful.
She assisted her father in battles, including battles against the Yuan dynasty of her great uncle Kublai Khan. In Kaidu Khan's clan, wrestling was a way of displaying physical strength, which was highly valued amongst the Mongols. All men of all shapes and sizes competed against each other, according to Marco Polo, actually, and other historians of the time, like Rashid al-Din, Kaidu wanted to see his only daughter get married, but she insisted that any man who wanted to marry her had to defeat her in wrestling.
Oh.
If a man won,
amazing,
she would marry him, and if he lost, he would give her 100 horses. She was undefeated. She gathered a horse of 10,000 horses.
Oh, Yes.
It's probably an exaggeration, but still, it was a lot of horses.
That's 100 men trying to wrestle her.
Literally. Literally. She remains stubborn about marriage against the wishes of her family, and according to Marco Polo, a very cocky suitor challenged her to wrestle, betting 1,000 horses instead of just 100. Marco Polo says that this man was a prince, and the night after meeting her, he went to her and begged her to throw the fight and promised to be good to her if they were married. According to Polo, she said to him that she would never let herself be vanquished if she could help it. If indeed he would get the better of her, then she would gladly be his wife. Of the actual battle itself, Marco Polo wrote, the damsel threw him right valiantly onto the palace pavement, and when he found himself thus thrown and her standing over him, great indeed was his shame and discomfiture.
Oh.
Ah. And Jeanette said, okay, except she wasn't a damsel, Marco, just saying.
Real. So real.
Rumors began to spread about Cuchulainn and her refusal to marry, like that she and her dad had an incestuous relationship.
Mm.
And she finally realized the problems her stubbornness was causing her family and decided to settle down. However, he didn't beat her at wrestling. She decided to marry somebody.
That's right. My body, my choice.
Exactly right. She did. So she does eventually marry, and sources vary about her husband's identity. Some say that he was a handsome man who had failed to assassinate her father and was taken prisoner, and Cuchulainn fell in love with him and they married.
That sounds likely.
Others say that he was a friend of her father's, and other sources say that she fell in love with Ghazan, a Mongol ruler in Persia. No matter the case, she chose who she married, which was really quite rare in the Mongol Empire. Cuchulainn is the only woman ever mentioned as owning a gurgi, which was a medallion given by the great Khan that signifies the power of the holder. Cuchulainn was her father's favorite child, and apparently he tried to name her as a successor to the Khanate before he died in 1301, but his choice was declined because she had male relatives. When Kaidu...
Freaking penises.
Literally. When Kaidu did eventually die, Cuchulainn guarded his tomb herself with the assistance of her brother Orus. She was challenged by her brothers because she resisted their succession, but Kaidu was replaced by a rival named Dua. Other sources say that she passed on the appointment of Khan on her own because she knew it would upset her older brothers.
Hmm.
She instead made a deal with one of them that she would back their claim to be Khan if he made her general over his army. And that's exactly what happened.
Oh.
Unfortunately, it didn't last for very long.
No. No. Oh, man.
She died in 1306 at the age of 46.
Wow.
Under unknown circumstances. I mean, unlikely she was killed on the battlefield. Or
probably.
She was assassinated.
Whew.
Almost immediately after, the Mongol Empire really began to crumble. In Mongol culture, she's remembered to this day as a famous athlete and warrior, but in more Western artistic depictions of her, she's seen as a proud woman who finally succumbs to love, undermining what she actually accomplished.
Yeah, duh.
Her story was passed down through Mongol culture, through oral history and folklore, and the story of Cuchulainn was rejected by the scribes at Kublai Khan's courts, and if Marco Polo hadn't felt compelled to write about her, she might have disappeared from history.
No.
Today, the traditional outfit worn by Mongolian wrestlers is open-chested, and apparently the reason is to show that the wrestler is not a woman, something that was adopted after Cuchulainn defeated everyone who challenged her. In a book of Asian tales and fables written by François Petit de la Croix in 1710, he tells the story of Cuchulainn but calls her Turnado, a Persian word meaning Central Asian daughter. In this story, she is depicted as the 19-year-old daughter of Altun Khan, the Mongol emperor of China. In this story, she doesn't wrestle her suitors, but has them answer 3 riddles, and they are executed if they can't solve them. And then her story has also been adapted into stage plays and opera, and of course, in Marco Polo. A little license taken, but
she
is a very strong, very powerful woman.
Beautiful.
Yes.
Want a whole movie, though.
Oh, my God.
And
yes.
I want the chick who plays Colleen Wing on Iron Fist and is also in Game of Thrones, and is still also on Game of Thrones. Maybe. I just want to watch everything. I just want it. I just want it all.
She is honestly one of the most badass people that we've had.
For real.
I'm obsessed.
Thanks for sharing.
Yes.
On a total side note, talk about love, not wrestling in the wrestling sense. Mm-hmm. But we'll talk about Madame Lou Graham. Mm-hmm. Here is a description of her from Seattle historian Bill Spiedel. Says she was, quote, about 5 feet, 2 inches, and at chest height, she was about 3 feet thick. She went for plumed hats and smart carriages. Lou stood for integrity in her field and a kind of class that couldn't be matched outside of the other major cities of the world, like San Francisco, New York, London, Paris.
Whoa.
She was a first-rate businesswoman who invested heavily and profitably in the stock market.
Yes, get
End
it.
Quote. All right. Okay. So she was born Dorothea Georgine Emile Aubin on February 9th, 1857. We have another source that says 1861. Sometime around there.
All right.
Not much is known about her prior to her arriving in Seattle in 1888.
Okay.
Seattle was a young city, was only about 3 decades old at that point. So Seattle was a frontier town. And frontier towns, when they first would get started, there was always more men than there were women because they lacked the kind of amenities that good women wanted towns to have.
Right.
So they had a lot of lonely men working on building railroads and saloons and things.
Right.
And thus a lot of not so good women or not so high class women.
Right.
Lots of prostitutes, obviously.
Right.
These ladies then, of course, because they're the only women in town offering such services, they tended to get a disproportionate share of the wealth in frontier towns and become very rich very quickly.
Okay.
And so the madams of these brothels became pretty much the wealthiest people in different towns.
Such an amazing thing to happen.
Right? So then in order to win the favor of these women who controlled all the wealth in their cities, the fathers of all these Western U.S. cities granted them suffrage.
That's a... Oh, Jesus.
So Seattle granted women suffrage on November 23rd, 1883.
A full, what, 36 years before Congress did it?
Yep. Unfortunately, though, there's instant regret to doing this because by that point, Seattle had been built up enough to attract, quote, good women who then got suffrage or who got then the ability to vote. And then they started to outnumber the prostitutes in the city. So they repaid kind of their sisters who had won them the vote by electing officials that cracked down on prohibition and enacted laws restricting saloons and brothels and gambling. So real struggle for power among
the
women.
Sure.
So there was a dramatic loss of tax and license revenues. So women's suffrage was revoked by 1887-88, and the city's finances were just in shambles. Like, it's a total topsy-turvy.
Oh my God.
It's an HBO series,
sure,
really.
Yeah,
like,
absolutely.
Who's in control? Who has the money? I don't know. So Bill Spiedel again says of Seattle during this time that, quote, the fines and licenses on liquor, gambling, and prostitution that had been the major source of income for the operation of the city dwindled to almost nothing.
Mm-hmm.
So the city's bankrupt. So Lou was actually the second most successful madam of the city. There's another madam known as Mother or Madam Damnable because of her foul mouth. She was also a prominent figure in the city with her own brothel, but she died in 1873, about 15 years before Lou Graham would arrive in Seattle. So we probably remember Lou more because of her financial contributions to the city.
Mm-hmm.
We're not really sure when she changed her name to Lou Graham, but it was before or right when she arrived in Seattle.
Right.
She approached Jacob Firth, a prominent banker, and proposed the establishment of a brothel that had comparable prices and quality to that of fancy hotels.
Oh.
Prices would be openly posted, and it would be staffed by women who were not only beautiful and, quote, talented, but also educated. So she succeeded in getting startup money from a few of the city's leading businessmen and purchased property at the corner of 3rd and Washington. Now, her first building burned down in the Great Seattle Fire in 1889, but she'd already made so much profit by that point that she could afford to rebuild the building in stone.
Oh,
so
my God.
So her initial parcel of land cost her $3,000.
Uh-huh.
The larger parcel that she bought after that was $25,000.
Oh, my God.
That's a lot of sex, guys.
That's a lot.
That's a lot. I'm just saying, that's like a lot. Because this is in the 1880s.
Yeah.
To go from 3,000 to 25,000, like, people are getting it on.
Yes, they are. And you know what? God bless them.
That's right. I mean, you do you, man. Or woman. Whatever you want. So her brothel was the first building to reopen after the fire. In
Listen,
a short amount of
a
time.
A city's got needs.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. In a short amount of time, about a couple of years, she had established the city's most refined parlor house. It was described as, quote, a discreet establishment for the silk top hat and frock coat set to indulge in good drink, lively political discussions, and upstairs ribald pleasures, all free to government representatives.
Oh, my.
Oh, snap. On February 14th in 1891, a rookie policeman arrested Graham during a general crackdown on prostitution in the city, not knowing who she was. Mm-hmm. And the result was an acquittal in a jury trial and the resignation of, quote, reform mayor, end quote, Henry White. Because clearly there's no reforming going on.
Right.
Her brothel was an institution for her whole life. People said of her establishment that no young businessman was really considered a man about town until he could discuss with ease the interior decorations of Lou's establishment.
Oh my God.
And some of the finer points of the distinguished young ladies.
That's amazing.
So the fortunes of Seattle,
the finer points.
Right? The fortunes of Seattle's leading families were founded on loans from Graham. When the banker who provided Graham her first loan for her business was approached with business ideas that he liked but didn't think would get approved by the board of directors at the Puget Sound National Bank, he would send them to Graham, who would provide the loan, but at a higher interest rate,
right,
but less formality.
Sure.
She even was instrumental in saving Firth's bank when a large number of people withdrew their accounts during the Panic of 1893. Mm. So she made a large deposit to the bank, essentially just keeping it afloat.
Right.
So when she died, an employee of that bank became the administrator of her estate. She's so wrapped up in this. She was savvy enough to know that political and social opinions could change at any moment. So she invested in the stock market, securing her own wealth if the brothel was ever forced to close. And there was another morality crusade in Seattle in 1902, and her brothel was closed. So instead of reopening it, Graham went to San Francisco, allegedly intending to start up business there. But she actually died in San Francisco in 1903. Oh. By the time of her death, she was one of the wealthiest landowners in the Pacific Northwest. She owned one of Seattle's greatest mansions, which was unfortunately demolished in the 60s, and contributed liberally to projects sponsored by the Seattle Chamber of Commerce. She contributed more money to children's education than the rest of the city's prominent early citizens combined.
Oh my God, now what a woman.
I know. So there are some suspicious circumstances or some suspicions surrounding her death. It's reported that she died of syphilis, but there are conspiracies that maybe it was foul play or it was suicide. Okay. The major evidence is that she died without leaving a will, which is pretty unusual for someone who's so astute in business and, and such a thinker and a planner to not have a will.
Right.
Seems a little fishy. And
interesting.
Then there is an article in the Seattle Times that says she made a will, but it was torn to shreds during a violent argument that Graham had with her housekeeper and rumored lesbian partner Amber the night before her death.
Oh.
And then, according to a few sources, she left her estate to relatives in Germany, but they turned out to be fraud. So her estate went to support the common schools of King County, where Seattle's located.
All right.
In any case, all of this money, her fortune at the time of her death was $200,000. That translates to roughly $5.1 million in today's money. And so Bill Spiegel, the historian who wrote the most of Graham, notes that traditional forms of documentation during this time essentially left out or underplayed the contributions that women made, and particularly, of course, less respectable women like Graham.
Of course.
So he got much of his research from two men, Henry Broderick and Joshua Green, but they wouldn't let him credit them until after their deaths. Now, here's what's the real kicker for me. The building of Graham's brothel still exists today and is now part of the Union Gospel Mission, which is just the best. It's just such a beautiful irony.
Yeah.
Yes.
Amazing.
So that's Madame Lou
Graham.
Yeah.
Using a basic human need to
Get some basic human need.
Right.
Mm-hmm. The Bitchery of History is brought to you by Audible.com. You can start your free trial and get a free audiobook by going to audibletrial.com/bitchery. This week, I am suggesting A Window Opens by Elizabeth Egan. It's a book that is more of a fun, rompy read. It's kind of a take on the struggle that women have it all and all of these things. So it follows an editor at a magazine and her compulsively honest just need to kind of have it all. And, you know, she's happily married, mother of three, and she's got a dog and all these things. And just kind of the struggle of that. So one to listen to while you're chilling at the beach.
Yeah, a summer beach day read.
Yeah.
Fantastic. And where can you get that again?
Audibletrial.com/bitchery.
Fantastic. Hey, friends. If you're enjoying this podcast, do Allison and myself a favor. Look down at that iPod or your laptop or, you know, whatever else you're listening to and give us a rating or a review. Those ratings and reviews, they help other people find the podcast, which helps us keep doing this podcast. And I know you want that. Thanks. All right. Today in history.
You got it.
What do we got?
So on August 11th, 1862, Sarah Bernhardt, actress, appeared on stage for the first time.
Yes. Love. On August 12th, 30 BC, Cleopatra VII. The last ruler of the Egyptian Ptolemaic dynasty commits suicide after the Battle of Actium and the death of Mark Antony.
On August 12th, 1990, Sue Hendrickson discovers the largest and most complete Tyrannosaurus rex skeleton found to date in South Dakota. The skeleton is called Sue in her honor and is on display at the Field Museum in Chicago.
Oh, my Lanta. That's amazing.
What's our turn this week, Max?
So this week, I thought we would talk about the difference between first, second, and third wave feminism.
Beautiful.
So I found a little bit of information that kind of helps to put dates on it. Mm-hmm. And then I thought we could talk about like what we thought the different waves of feminism
absolutely.
Were. So the first wave kind of starts in the early 1830s, early 1900s to the early 1900s. And this is really when women first realized they wanted to start getting political power, when they were able to start really collecting themselves together, when they realized that getting the vote would be the thing to really help them change conditions. The second wave starts around the 60s and 80s when they start coming off the heels of World War II, when we're starting to focus on workplace, sexuality, family, and reproductive rights. And then the third wave we're talking about, we're getting even smaller. So we're talking about...
It's like the 1990s to right now,
to right now, yeah, to what we're going through now. And actually, some people are starting to say we're entering like a fourth wave of feminism. So that's kind of the three main parts.
I think to me, what I think of is like early feminism kind of starting with A Doll's House, which is a fairly famous play, I would say.
Yeah,
I mean, it's famous
by Henrik
Ibsen.
If
you're in theater, but I think kind of outside theater as well.
Absolutely.
And just the idea of wanting more and wanting more say.
And a woman making a choice
for herself. And more power. And then kind of leading up to the vote. And then, the second wave to me is kind of 1960s. That's when I think about like bra burning and things of that nature. But coming out of the 50s and that struggle, there's so many movies of the 50s where housewives are just slowly dying
shrugging
themselves to death because they're so unhappy. And I think we are in a third wave right now. And I think that some of the struggle is in letting go of the previous two waves or the previous three waves if we're in a fourth wave and saying, you know, that was then and that was the struggle that was then and that was the context.
Right.
But this is the fight that we have now and these are the things that we need to focus on now.
Absolutely. The way I've liked to explain it to people, at least as far as I understand it, is like the first wave of feminism was getting the seat at the table. It was coming to the table.
Yeah.
The second wave of feminism is, okay, now you have your seat at the table. Now you have to fight to get your voice heard at that table.
Yeah.
And then the third wave, which I think I would agree we're in right now, is, okay, now that your voice is being heard, what are you doing with it? It's actually exercising that right.
Yeah.
And so we're starting to see, I mean, the Women's March is such an amazing example of, okay, you've got your seat at the table. Your voice is being heard. What are you saying? And it was, I mean, talk about making a statement at that Women's March.
An entire gender came out and protested against the man upstairs.
The single,
more than one gender.
Oh, absolutely. Literally the single largest one-day protest in the history of this nation was a march of women.
That's amazing. Because bitches get stuff done.
Bitches get stuff done. So that's kind of a very, it's a very loose definition of what the different waves are. But
it's a broad view, but I think it's important to acknowledge the history and the past and where we're coming from, but then where we are now.
Absolutely.
It gives you a better leg to stand on when people say that they aren't a feminist and you want to punch them in the face.
Right. And what is your brother used to put? What did your brother always used to put at the end of his book reports? If you want to know more.
If you want to know more, read the book.
Yeah.
And if you want to do more, write the book.
Mind oh, drop. Dang.
Oh, dang. Bring in the power. We've got a cool cause this week.
Yes. Hope for Justice. You can find them at hopeforjustice.org.
And they exist to bring an end to modern slavery by rescuing victims, restoring lives, and reforming society. They believe freedom is worth the fight. Justice is non-negotiable. They refuse to abandon the least, the last, and the lost. They challenge apathy with actions, greet cynicism with hope, and are purposeful, passionate, and pioneering. And I wanted to do this cause because talking about Madame Lou Graham, I mean, certainly people used to choose to be prostitutes or maybe not choose. Maybe they had limited choices.
Right.
But it was a way to make a financial living and was more or less a choice. But there is a lot of modern day slavery and modern day sex trafficking.
Absolutely.
That people need to be more aware of is a real issue that is happening and going on. So I just wanted to raise awareness on that today with this cause.
Absolutely. And you can find them at hopeforjustice.org. So The Bitchery of History is a production of Ursula Major Productions.
What are our new social media handles again?
Instagram is now at The Bitchery of History.
Perfect.
Twitter is Bitchery Podcast.
Perfect.
Facebook, just search The Bitchery of History.
It's you'll find exact us. Same. I love it.
And Patreon is still patreon.com/UrsulaMajor.
Because The Bitchery of History is a production of Ursula Major Productions.
Yes, ma'am.
With the help of our amazing team.
Oh, my God.
Jeanette.
Kim.
Sydney.
Steph.
Keegan.
Dan.
Jess.
I think I said Jess. Say it again.
And Steph.
And Steph. I think we said Steph
and
too.
All the people.
And all the people. It's an amazing team. You guys honestly do amazing work. And I'm so excited for season 3.
Woohoo! Yes. And as always, bitches get stuff done.